Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites, your food is our passion.
From the earliest days of film and TV, Christian stories have always been there. Which makes sense for a country as Christian as this one. Religious entertainment does well, it always has. But these days, there's a new twist on the old form. There's a television series called The Chosen. It's a drama about the life of Jesus that's become a global hit. It's now in its fifth season. And part of its success comes from the way it was put together. It was launched with crowdfunded money, and it grew with the help of an audience that promoted it and turned it into a phenomenon. But the journalist Rachel Monroe says there's something else going on. In a new article for The New Yorker, she says The Chosen is helping to create a new model for Christian entertainment. The show's creator is a man named Dallas Jenkins, and he's taken his inspiration not from the earlier generations of religious storytelling, but from prestige television. So the show focuses on really complicated characters and relationships and the messy human lives surrounding a story that most viewers already know. Monroe says The Chosen is attracting major investors and creators who see faith-based entertainment as more than just a niche market. And then there's the Utah connection to the story. Latter-day Saint entrepreneurs who have helped the series find its audience and have helped build the business model. Rachel Monroe begins her article with a woman named Carla Cameron.
She teaches Bible study classes to teenagers at her Catholic church, which is a hard enough thing to do to keep their attention. And then pandemic happens. All of this is now on Zoom. And she starts looking around, trying to find some biblical content that she can share with them, and is just really frustrated with everything that she sees. One sticking point for her that she kept bringing up was like, everybody always had costumes with zippers on them. You know, there were no zippers in the first century. It all just was kind of cheesy and not relatable. And then she started hearing about a show that was relatively new at that time called The Chosen.
Your head hurting you again?
No.
I know. You are thinking of the big new star.
The first episode is really kind of disconcerting. Like, you're kind of thrown into this first century world.
Why have you stopped us?
It's not enough to say hello.
I'm on official business.
Only Roman business is official business.
You don't even see the character of Jesus, who's played by the actor Jonathan Rumi, until the very end of the episode. Instead, you're spending a lot of time with Mary Magdalene.
To your nephew. One of your nephews.
And she's clearly portrayed as having essentially like a mental health crisis.
Hold something valuable.
People are talking, they're making food, they're going to work. It's just a very different portrayal of this first century world. She and her husband stayed up that night and kind of went through their Bible and kept being able to match certain lines from the show or certain plot points to the scripture. So she was impressed by it aesthetically, but also how faithful it was to that original text. And for Carla, it was important. No zippers. No zippers. Everybody's costumes looked authentic.
Yeah, the zippers thing was important to her. That mattered.
Very much.
Yeah. You say the series became a companion for her.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just that she liked watching the show, but it's this whole world surrounding the show. It has a fandom, essentially. And, you know, she starts joining Facebook groups and realizes that there's just this whole world of people online who are as compelled by this show as she is. You know, she makes a biblical study guide and is just watching it on Zoom with groups. And it really becomes not just a show that she likes watching, but a whole social world.
What did all of this particular story, Carla's story of finding this show and having it become so important to her, what did that tell you about where religion fits in popular culture today? Like, what was the thing that you took away from that particular experience, but the story you're telling in the piece?
I think what was so interesting to me about Carla's experience and other fans of The Chosen was just how important it is for people to have this fandom experience, to feel like they're part of a movement, part of something bigger than them. And that's really like what media has to do these days to capture people's attention in our like kind of short attention span, media saturated world. And it was just so interesting to me how we've really seen shows like The Chosen especially have been so good at creating this sense of community and finding alternative ways to distribute and market and even pay for their content. And, you know, just wondering like how they're on the cutting edge and what can be learned from what The Chosen seems to have figured out.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Rachel Monroe is our guest today. She's a contributing writer at The New Yorker. Her article is called Act of Faith.
You know, I live in Texas, and I had been hearing just rumors that there was a show about the life of Jesus that was set in the Holy Land, and that the Holy Land, that it was filmed like outside of Fort Worth. And that was kind of funny to me because I don't think of that as like a particularly holy place. Personally, in my experience, I just associate it with traffic.
Yeah.
But then once it kind of like was in my mind as something, I started just seeing how hugely popular it was. And it was hugely popular on one sense, but on another sense, it was like very much not kind of in mainstream awareness. So the fans of the show were completely obsessed with it.
Yeah.
And its stars and its creator were like huge celebrities to them. And then if you talk to people kind of outside that world of Christian media, they had no idea, had never heard of it, were like completely clueless. And that disjunct, the fact that something could be both so powerful and so unknown, was so fascinating to me.
It seems like a lot of things are kind of coming together to make this such a phenomenon. I mean, part of it was what you describe as its relatable depiction of Jesus and his followers, which we'll come back to here in a second. But the other part was this, just how good they are at marketing. Like they're really, they've found this kind of secret sauce about how to focus on a particular group and really get them interested.
Yeah, I think it's just it's like a marketing case study that I think people really should dig into and look into. Like, I mean, on the one hand, you have an audience that it's almost perfectly receptive for the way that things are in today's media environment. Loving the show, sharing the show became a kind of like ministry almost. People of faith who watched the show and connected to the show felt really like, not just that they wanted to share it, but they felt like really kind of spiritually compelled to share it and to urge other people to watch. And at the same time, the show is crowdfunded, especially in the early seasons. It was almost entirely crowdfunded. And donating was kind of like a form of tithing. This is an audience that's used to giving money to things that they support and to, you know, shouting from the mountaintop. And so I think that really helped propel the show forward to the success that it has had.
I think the aesthetic part of it is interesting, too, because there's this impression that from some that Christian films are just, they're crappy, they're cheesy, they're one dimensional, they lack a kind of elevated style or, you know, sophistication. They offer a kind of really simple conservative view of Christianity. But it seems like that's not really fair when you're talking about some of these things. Certainly The Chosen in some ways. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. I think the creator of The Chosen, Dallas Jenkins, is a, you know, a lifelong, like strongly faithful, Bible believing evangelical. And even he will say most Christian movies, certainly most Bible movies, like are not fun to watch.
Yeah.
He doesn't like them. Because I think he would say they approach the stories with this sense of reverence, which almost leads to kind of like an anxiety, not wanting to ruffle feathers. And that often makes for kind of like bad or mediocre culture. And so his intention for this was to have something that had both a strong connection to faith, like a depiction of his faith, but that was also like aesthetically had really strong aesthetic standards.
Yeah.
And people, it turns out, were pretty hungry for that.
We'll come back to Jenkins and his influences. I think his father's really interesting. The movies that his dad showed him, which seems to have affected his sense of taste. But before that, let's talk about the subculture that comes, that kind of grows up around the Chosen. Let's go to Chosen Con, this convention for fans of the Chosen that Carla Cameron went to. Talk a little bit about the atmosphere of this conference.
So Chosen Con is the annual fan convention for The Chosen, the television show. And I went this past year. It was being held in North Carolina, and I think there were attendance was somewhere around 5,000 people. So it was really quite significant. And it was just the most overwhelmingly kind crowd that I have ever been a part of.
Yeah.
I mentioned in the piece that my shoe came untied, and which I only noticed because I looked down and there was somebody bending before me, kind of like reverently tying my shoe, a total stranger. But everybody was like that. It was just so much hugging and kind of a sort of like overwhelming experience of fellowship, kindness, togetherness. Mm. People were so happy to be there and to be sharing this experience. There were panel talks from the various actors, but there were also some more interactive things going on. They had a kind of Last Supper experience room, which had the Last Supper set from the show that people could go in. There was a prayer room where people prayed both individually and collectively. There was a Christian music concert. There were various places where people could, you know, write their prayers for people on the show or other people. And everybody, the show has kind of chosen this, the show has a signature color, which is like a teal.
Yeah.
And almost everybody was wearing merch from the show, much of it in that teal. I mean, it really was like, you know, a Taylor Swift concert or something like that, whereas like everybody is wearing their chosen outfit to the chosen convention and a giant gift shop.
Yeah. Yeah. Trading cards and canvas jackets and coffee mugs, the whole schmear, I guess.
Just like anything that you could want to buy, you could buy a chosen version of it at the gift shop, basically.
How big is it, The Chosen, just as a phenomenon and as a show? And here's just something you mentioned in the piece. When we're talking about the producers trying to get seasons 6 funded, more than 100,000 people donated more than $70 million to do it.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, I mean, and that's just the crowdfunding part of it. Certainly many more people are watching and not donating. You know, it's like a little tricky to get all the statistics you want from these streaming services these days, but it is regularly in the Amazon Prime top 10. Sometimes, you know, when a new season comes out, it's the number one show on the Amazon Prime and just has a rabid fan base, both nationally, and I think it's important to say internationally. It's sometimes it, you know, takes one of the top spots in countries all over the world. So just, a huge phenomenon.
So one of the things you write about is the kind of interesting history between Hollywood and Christian filmmakers and Christian films. Most Americans, as you say, are Christian, which is a fact. This is how you put it in the piece, that Hollywood regularly seems to remember, forget, and then remember again. Give us a little sense of the history of this relationship.
Sure. I mean, you know, you can go as far back as you want. There were some hit biblical epics in the 1950s. You know, you think about the Ten Commandments or Ben-Hur.
Yeah.
But then really Hollywood largely stepped away from biblical content for a long time, with certain exceptions, of course. I guess one huge point on the timeline is when Passion of the Christ came out in the early 2000s, which was just a huge and like overwhelming hit. And then in the immediate aftermath of that, Hollywood is like, oh my gosh, we got to do more of that, and green lights you know, I think there was a Noah movie, just all of these other kind of big biblical epics, which all then, you know, do really badly at the box office. Then, you know, no more Christian movies for a while. And then you start to see these kind of more independently produced Christian movies. There's one called God's Not Dead, which did really well. And then, you know, all of a sudden, Hollywood's like making more Christian movies again. So it's just, it seems to be this kind of ebb and flow of trying to figure out how the industry can kind of cater to this audience. And it's, you know, it's a tricky audience in some ways. It's, they don't want to be pandered to. So you can't just, you know, make a movie from a Bible story and expect that it's going to be a big hit. But when they are hits, they do tend to be big hits.
That's interesting. You say that they don't want to be pandered to. So it's, so just making the really cheesy stuff that's been made, they don't want that. They're like any movie, you know, discerning movie going audience. They want something good, I guess you're saying.
Yeah, well, what was so interesting to me was talking to people both within the Christian film industry and then talking in the film industry more broadly, kind of comparing the faith audience to the anime audience or to the horror movie audience, which, you know, on the surface, you'd be like, well, that doesn't make any sense. But I think once you kind of pause and think about it, it's like, oh, yeah, there's sort of an aesthetic sensibility. These are audiences that maybe the industry has looked down on or not fully respected for a long time. But when you have people doing good work in that niche, the audiences will really flock to it because they're hungry for things that feel to them like high quality, you know, made for them, made by people who understand the standards and the kind of roles of the genre.
That niche, I think, is an important theme in the piece that you write, because you mentioned how the success of media projects is increasingly, this is you writing here, is increasingly driven by devoted fan bases rather than a widespread appeal. So is that where we're headed in entertainment, rather than trying to draw on, you know, broad themes? Get super specific, get hyper-focused, appeal to a kind of a base.
That's certainly what I heard over and over again from people who have expertise in the industry, that trying to kind of cater to everybody means you're sort of making movies for nobody. And that's, you know, we see every year there's so many of these movies that are made for just hundreds of millions of dollars that nobody ends up seeing. And so I think this is something that the Christian film industry, the faith film industry has been doing for a while, is being just super targeted in their marketing. Also, you know, have a history of making films for like a very low budget, like keeping the budgets super tight.
Yeah.
And it seems like, you know, this is the way Hollywood is kind of discovering this methodology more broadly, and the Christian film industry got there a little earlier.
You were mentioning earlier the days in American culture when there was the Ten Commandments, you know, and then there was Ben-Hur, and people regularly would, you know, watch it on television, but also these were big hits. But then you write about how those, the old distinctions between what was a religious film and a mainstream film, that went away for a while. Is it coming back? Are those distinctions going to be dissolved now, and are we going to see more of this kind of thing in broader popular culture, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, as mainstream Hollywood has been struggling, it is interesting to watch how the cues that they are taking from successful shows like The Chosen, these kind of grassroots phenomena that spring up. So there has been a great increase in investment, speculative investment, in people making Christian content or faith-based content, or sometimes it's called faith-friendly film and TV. Yeah. So these aren't necessarily, you know, a biblical show, but it might have Christian themes without being sort of necessarily explicitly a Christian movie, family friendly. All these categories get kind of blurry. But so, you know, some of these filmmakers, Christian filmmakers who had been making movies, couldn't really get studio financing. All of a sudden, you know, there's big investment from MGM, Amazon in a lot of these shows. Netflix as well, just kind of trying to chase this audience, because it does seem like these are these are audience members who are still consuming a lot of media and also going to the theater. I didn't get into that too much in the piece that I wrote, but these are people who actually still go to the movie theater, which is something that Hollywood is always trying to figure out, the magic recipe for making that happen.
Rachel Monroe, she's a contributing writer at The New Yorker. Her article is called Act of Faith, How the Chosen Spurred a Golden Age of Christian Filmmaking. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites, your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We have Rachel Monroe on the program today. She has a piece in The New Yorker magazine that looks at the massive popularity of the television series The Chosen and what it says about the current moment in Christian storytelling. It started as a crowdfunded project about the life of Jesus, but it has become a global hit. And Monroe says it's helping drive this larger shift in how faith-based entertainment gets made and financed and marketed. She follows that shift inside the industry and the fan communities around it, which, by the way, includes a Mormon connection that helped shape the show's success. Rachel, how do you understand this Christian subculture that's watching The Chosen? I mean, you mentioned they're not going to church as much. People are just not going to church, but they're believers. So how do you understand the subculture that The Chosen is appealing to?
Well, I don't know if that's those statistics are true of The Chosen's audience.
They go to church.
You know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I would assume that that's the case. I don't have statistics on that. But yeah. I mean, basically, you know, what we've seen, if you look at these kind of big demographic surveys like by Pew or whatever, while the majority of Americans still identify as Christians, there's been a big decline since, you know, about the early mid-90s in kind of religious observation. So this is, you know, going to church every week, belonging to a church, like all of those things have really kind of fallen off the cliff since the 90s. And so that was kind of interesting to me in thinking about this story, that maybe for the first time in the history of this country, Christians seem to sort of feel like a minority, or certainly like religiously observant Christians, that used to kind of be the ambient American culture. And it's just really not anymore. But I think for people who religious observance is still a really important part of their life, now they become a niche that can be marketed to. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
so even though
they're
maybe a smaller group, it's a more tightly held identity category, which makes them, more kind of amenable to marketing.
I want to talk a little bit more about Dallas Jenkins, the creator of The Chosen, co-writer of the show. Tell us a little bit about him. Let's see. I'm going through your details here. Tall, chiseled, cold plunge devotee, built like a football player. Kermit the Frog with biceps is one way you describe him. Tell us about Dallas Jenkins.
I really like Dallas. He's in his early 50s. And yeah, like I said, he's like an enormous, he's a very physically imposing guy. He told me that he sometimes gets mistaken for a football player in the airport sometimes. But his affect is actually just very like kind of sweet and gentle and goofy. He is the brains behind this show. He's the showrunner. He's one of the co-writers. He's the director. I mean, it's just completely his brainchild. And it's an interesting history that he has, because he is in some ways evangelical royalty, and especially in the kind of world of evangelical culture, mass media.
Well, explain what you mean. This gets us to his father, Jerry.
Yeah. So Jerry Jenkins, who's Dallas's father, was the co-author of the Left Behind books, which have sold, you know, tens of millions of copies. These are these books that were very popular 90s, early 2000s, a kind of post-rapture world, taking a lot of cues from the Book of Revelation, kind of scary, as I recall. I haven't read them, but friends of mine who kind of grew up in the evangelical church, I think we're a little scarred by some of these stories. But they were just like a huge, huge phenomenon. And so this is kind of the family context that Dallas Jenkins comes out of. Although it's interesting, this sort of hit money celebrity didn't come to Dallas's father, Jerry, until he was in midlife, which is sort of the same as Dallas, too. Dallas was already kind of an adult when the Left Behind series really hit big.
Well, what seems to, at least on some level, distinguish Dallas Jenkins from other Christian filmmakers, and maybe this is unfair, but it does seem to be that he has a more, like elevated sense of taste than others. His ideas seem to come from secular art more than maybe from inside the faith. And that's because his dad took him to really good movies when he was a kid.
Yeah, it was an interesting part of the story for me because, you know, the Jenkins family, very strong evangelicals, you know, go to Christian schools, compete in Bible memorization contests, are consuming like almost entirely Christian media. Dallas said something like, you know, we were taught to regard the average movie as you know, an enemy or something. But Jerry Jenkins does have this soft spot in his heart for just like good Hollywood, good classic mainstream Hollywood movies. And so when Dallas is, I think, you know, around eighth, ninth grade, his father decides he's mature enough to handle it. And they just start watching, you know, A Clockwork Orange, The Godfather, just all the kind of classics. And I think those movies made a huge impression on Dallas. And that has always kind of been his quest. And then later in life, he will talk about, you know, really loving The Wire, Friday Night Lights, Breaking Bad. You know, these shows that are like not, certainly not like Christian, faith-based, not even faith-friendly, I would say, TV shows. That's kind of what he's watching. That's what he loves to watch. And that's, his inspiration is the Bible, but his inspiration is also Breaking Bad, which makes for an interesting combination.
I mean, totally. I mean, the moral complexity in something like The Wire or Breaking Bad, that would appeal to someone like him. And he's, as you mentioned in the piece, he is hoping to push audiences, to challenge them, to, as he put it, to watch with a little more nuance or a little more care. That is something he's going for.
Yeah, and it's interesting to speak with him about this because he's very careful. He doesn't want to seem like he's condescending to his audience at all. And he understands that people sometimes want to go to culture not necessarily to be challenged, to be soothed, to be comforted, to be, you know, buoyed up in their spirits. And I think he tries to deliver that. But he also does. He's interested in that kind of human complexity and nuance and wanted to bring that to the stories of the Gospels and the stories of Jesus. And I think because he did, I think his audience does sometimes kind of struggle with what he's trying to do. There was a kind of a big kerfluffle. They're telling the story of the Last Supper and the episodes will kind of cut back between the Last Supper and then sort of flashback. And so it's just told in this kind of jigsaw puzzle sort of way, which is like not as very standard, I think, in you know, an HBO show, but was maybe like a little jarring for some of the audience of The Chosen. But I think because Dallas has cultivated this very close connection with the audience, he could just, people were willing to kind of go there with him in a way that they might have been turned off or alienated if this was happening in a different piece of culture. But they're like, okay, he's doing something here. Like, let's sit with it and see how this all comes together.
Well, and then there's this he told you. Let me quote it. People are spending hours with Judas. They love Judas. What is he trying to explain there? Because that people are sort of embracing one of the sort of evil figures in the story of Jesus is, I think, interesting.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's like makes a big difference. I think the medium, the fact that this is a you know, 7-season-long show and not a 2-hour movie. Yeah. So you really see these characters' arcs. And there's a lot more focus on the disciples and the apostles. I mean, there's a big focus on Jesus. He's the star of the show. But
sure.
There's like these, the his followers. We spend probably more time with them than we do with Jesus himself on the show. And so they all just have these character arcs and little side plots, and they're just portrayed as human beings, and that includes Judas. And so you just, every character has motivations, even characters who you kind of know, if you know the story of the Bible at all, what they're going to end up doing. The show portrays the backstory, the characterization. Everybody has motivations, even if their motivations might lead them to do bad things later.
As a non-believer, what did you make of the portrayal of Jesus from what you've seen in The Chosen? You mentioned that this is portrayed by Jonathan Rumi, who plays Jesus in the series. Hunky and sexless is one way you say, but he also, like, he dances and is brooding and makes jokes and, like, he's relatable. He's earthy.
He's a very, like, soulful portrayal of Jesus, I would say. He's very emotional. He gets sad. He laughs and he jokes, but it seems like you really feel sort of the weight of it on the character. I mean, I think Jonathan, it's like, what a hard character to play, you
yeah.
know? You just have to, like, really have resonance and the charisma. And I think Jonathan Rumi, he's also sort of a physically imposing presence on screen. But it's all, the whole show is like very much kind of underlying the humanity. The kind of closing seasons of the show, I think, it sort of starts to move more in the direction of the divinity.
Yeah.
But the humanity early on, I think, is very sort of touchingly portrayed.
Part of this story involves some Latter-day Saints. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about how maybe, if not Mormonism, Mormons play out in the story. And this gets us to how The Chosen really sort of takes off. It's the what you describe as The Chosen's lore, where Dallas Jenkins stops striving for worldly success, surrenders to God, figures he's not going to make it necessarily, and he makes this little short film, and that becomes to the attention of these two guys in Provo. Would you just sort of tell us a little bit more about how this comes to Jeffrey and Neil Harmon? Those are the two guys.
Yeah, Dallas Jenkins is so successful with this show now that it's easy to sort of forget that the show had very humble beginnings. So Dallas Jenkins had been making Christian movies to various degrees of success. And he made a film, kind of a Christian rom-com, that was basically a total flop.
Yeah.
He had a lot of hope set on it, and it just, like, people did not go watch it. So he was at a very low ebb in his career. And the way that he describes it is he just sort of, like, realized he needed to stop kind of angling, you know, ambitiously going after success, and really needed to surrender to God. Mm. Out of that kind of conviction, he makes a short film about the birth of Jesus from the perspective of the shepherds for his church service. And this film kind of makes its way to the Harmon brothers, who are kind of very skilled media entrepreneurs and LDS members who are living in Utah. And they just realize that there's potential here. Dallas has been wanting to turn this into a show. The Harmons have some media savvy and some capital, and that's sort of the birth of the early seasons of The Chosen.
This gets us to Angel Studios. That's the name of the – what is it now? Is it Angel?
Now it's just Angel.
Angel, yeah. It used to be Angel – Studios, and you mentioned how, and I think people around here will remember this, Jeffrey and Neil Harmon, they founded this thing called VidAngel, which was this service that let people skip through the, you know, the bad words or the nudity or whatever of the TV shows, and they got sued, but then they used the suit as this sort of fundraising opportunity. Like, they're really innovative in the way they sort of work through the system. And it's a kind of, I think you describe it as a kind of antagonism around establishment media.
Yeah, I think they would probably dispute that. But that's sort of how it seems to me, is just a way of like looking at the current kind of mainstream and sort of seeing how they and their audiences and faith audiences are not being served, and being like, okay, how can we disrupt this? And how can we, you know, find a way to get our audiences what they want? And so VidAngel came out of that. And then VidAngel, as you said, kind of got, there was a big lawsuit from Disney and some of the other major studios, and that kind of contributed to the bankruptcy of VidAngel. But then the Harmons do this kind of fascinating pivot and decide to start both making and also distributing media on their own. And that's how Angel Studios, now Angel, gets born, and their first scripted show was The Chosen.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, one of the sort of strategies they have is that they have these members, guild members, and they can make notes on projects. How does that work?
It's so fascinating to me. And I think it's just really, you know, we were talking earlier about how the faith-based filmmaking world has been kind of quick to embrace these innovations. And I think that the Angel's mode of approving and financing and promoting films is a key example of that. So they have a thing called the Angel Guild, which has, you know, a couple million members at this point, and they pay to be a member of the guild, and they kind of review prospective movies that Angel might acquire, distribute, and they can, you know, they can vote yes or no. They can provide notes, you know. And then if the guild approves of a movie, then it'll get acquired. And so it's really just kind of applying this wisdom of the crowd approach to a film studio, you know, rather than having these, you know, suits up in Hollywood, you know, deciding like, what do people want to see? You know, this is good, this is bad. You have the people is the idea behind it. And, you know, it's, I think they've had some remarkable successes, and they're not, certainly not every movie is a huge hit, but they've had some hits with movies also that other studios were maybe leery of.
Rachel Munro, we're talking about her article about the rise of Christian filmmaking. It appears in the June 1st issue of The New Yorker. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about a recent article in The New Yorker today. Rachel Munro is writing about The Chosen. It's the hit TV series about the life of Jesus that has triggered this new era in Christian filmmaking. The show has attracted tens of millions of viewers, but more than that, it has this devoted fan base that's been the secret to its success. Munro is looking at how all of this came together, how it was crowdfunded, and it has connections, by the way, with entrepreneurs here in Utah. I want to come back to someone you mentioned before. He's a really important in part of this story, and that's a man named Daryl Eaves. He has what you describe as this preternatural feel for online video and viral marketing campaigns. He's a Latter-day Saint himself.
He is. He's one of, I think, like 10 children, I can't remember, you know, grew up without a lot of money in Utah, and then kind of discovered YouTube in the early 2000s and just kind of got it. He's played a role in like so many, kind of behind the scenes role in so many of these YouTube phenomena.
Mr. Beast, one of them.
Exactly. I was going to say that really like kind of knocked my socks off a little bit when he kind of discovered a young man who just had a couple of million followers and was like, I think this kid's got something. Advised him and kind of gave him some, helped kind of steer his career and the shape of his content. And now it's Mr. Beast, who's like the most famous person kind of on the planet, basically.
Yeah.
So he also played, he got in right around the time he started advising Mr. Beast. He also kind of got in with The Chosen and another thing that blew up. So he's got a little bit of that magic touch.
How do you describe his skill, his gift? And I wonder, you don't really get into this in the piece, but is his Mormonism part of what he understands about all of this? I mean, it's a proselytizing church. They're good at trying to spread the word as well in interesting and innovative ways. What do you think about that?
You know, I certainly asked him about that, and he didn't have a great answer about it, but it certainly seems to me, if you see not just Daryl Eves' skill with The Chosen, with Mr. Beast, but how much content we're seeing from LDS creators. Yeah. You know, it's like half of reality television seems to be like from that world now, and influencers. And, you know, I wonder if there is like some ability, if you're not sort of seeing a path through kind of like mainstream Hollywood, it's like, okay, I've got to like reach an audience. I have to build my own way to reach an audience. And that has turned out to be a really incredibly useful skill in this day and age. But that's all just my theorizing. That wasn't Daryl Eves. That's not necessarily his perspective.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you mentioned that Dallas Jenkins tries to stay away from the themes that would divide Christians. 'Cause there's a lot of, you know, doctrinal divisions between Christians, of course. And he tries to sort of stay away from that. And he also tries to be more nuanced, less didactic, you say. And I guess that surprised me. It's I guess the impression for a lot of people is that the reason these things do well is because they don't have nuance, is that they really lean into kind of the culture war stuff. You engage people or enrage them or whatever, and you're going to get followers. But it seems like Jenkins might not be as interested in that as a concept.
Yeah, I found that really interesting, too. I mean, and I think there are two parts of that that are maybe separate but also related. So on the one hand, he kind of sees his audience very broadly from a doctrinal perspective. He is a strong evangelical, but there are Catholics, and as you say, like there are Mormons deeply involved in the show, and he sees all of those people as his audience. I think the show has I think I describe it as having an evangelical sensibility. I think that's the case, but it's not an anti-Catholic show, or it's not trying to, you know, wage a fight, you know, through its storylines with different categories of believers. It's really trying to appeal to everybody. And also, you know, the show says that there's some percentage of the viewers are non-Christians. So on the one hand, there's that, which I think is really remarkable. Like, I think that a show could be this, like, kind of Latter-day Saint / Catholic / evangelical production. You know, if you took a time machine back 20 or 30 years and told people, they'd find that, I think, surprising.
Yeah, yeah.
And then maybe kind of alongside that, you know, the show is really not trying to be a piece of culture war propaganda. I think it probably helps that it's set in the first century, so a lot of the signifiers of the contemporary culture war are just absent.
Yeah.
And that just really seems to be not what Dallas Jenkins is interested in. I mean, he's very clear about his personal beliefs. He describes himself sometimes as a conservative, sometimes as a libertarian, but I think his interest is not in culture war battles, but in getting his message out to as many people as possible. So I found that, honestly, like as a non-believer who watched a lot of faith-based movies and film and TV shows for this show, I found it like really refreshing to not, I don't know, a lot of these, especially like more contemporary Christian films can have this feeling of like being kind of defensive and embattled. Yeah. And there's always like some character who is, you know, like me, like an atheist journalist woman or something. Yeah. And who's like usually just gets like becomes like the punching bag for the movie in some way, or, you know, has to learn her lesson. And there was never anything like that while watching The Chosen.
How much of that contributed to the fact that The Chosen has now parted ways with Angel? One of the things you mentioned is Jenkins was not crazy about what he described as this culture war dynamic at Angel. I mean, there was other things like the marketing seemed limiting to him and other stuff. But I wonder how much of that was just too much for Jenkins.
You know, that's how Dallas Jenkins characterized it to me, is sort of feeling like not wanting to participate into like a culture war dynamic. I think Angel would dispute that. I mean, this is like a very contentious legal battle, so I probably can't say too much about it. But, you know, I think both sides seem to have come away from that feeling. I don't know. They're no longer speaking, I guess I will say. So there's that collaboration is certainly over.
Well, it came up. We talked to a filmmaker about this named Matt Whitaker. It was about he had made this film called Truth and Treason. And it's about this young Mormon boy from Germany who defies Hitler and the Nazis. He's executed by the Nazis. And it's a film that was distributed by Angel. And Whitaker, who is also a Latter-day Saint, like a lot of the leaders of Angel, talked to us about how – I mean, he was careful, but he was not always happy with the way the film was marketed, said that it did try to sort of lean into more cultural war things. And, it really bothered him. So he – seems like he had a similar kind of reaction that Dallas Jenkins may have had, I guess.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think there are we're seeing a little bit of a – it'll be interesting to see kind of what mode of attracting, driving audiences ends up winning out. Does it make sense to be kind of capacious and be like, this is for everybody? Or, again, kind of to double down and say, like, other people won't understand, you know, this is for us and not for them, can really energize audiences too. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
You come around in the article to this question of whether or not The Chosen is becoming too Hollywood. You know, they'll lose sense of their roots. What do you make of where this is headed? And not just with The Chosen, but with Dallas Jenkins and series and Christian art like this, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's an open question for me. I will say none of the fans that I spoke to voiced that concern. None of the fans that I spoke to had any criticisms at all of anything.
Yeah.
Very devoted fan base. But it's interesting because the show did grow from this crowdfunded, you know, fairly scrappy situation where really, you know, Dallas Jenkins was like going on live streams, raising $1 million, you know, that they needed to like for the production budget, you know, to make the next episode. And now they have a deal with Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
They have theatrical distribution. They are getting, you know, still doing the crowdfunding, but they also have like deep pocketed Christian donors. I believe Dallas said, you know, 7-8 figure donations. So it's not this kind of scrappy little can-do show anymore. I mean, it's like a bona fide phenomenon. And so I did wonder, you know, when we're in this huge convention center with this like gift shop with like lines out the door, how does it maintain that feeling of being kind of vital and grassroots, or is that essential to it? But honestly, the fans, that seemed to be like a tension that I was sensing, but I don't know if it matters to the fans at all. For them, I think the story of the show, how it was this kind of remarkable success, grassroots success, and their connection to Dallas Jenkins, that kind of trumps everything.
Yeah. It seems like one thing that occurred to me is the thing that a lot of religious people, you know, regardless of where they are doctrinally, you know, about certain things, they're looking for community. And it seems like they're getting community from this TV show.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we haven't talked about it too much, but another innovation that the show had was enlisting its fans to serve as extras. And like on the order of like thousands and thousands of extras. So if you donate a certain amount to the show, you could participate and be in the background of, you know, the feeding of the 5,000 or the Sermon on the Mount. And that kind of participatory quality in real life, you know, there's a robust online component. But the fact that it also there are these in-person things, ChosenCon, or these moments when you can kind of come be an extra on set. really kind of bonds people to each other, to the show, and I think just makes it even stronger, this connection that people have to this show.
Well, you mentioned Carla. We talked about her, and she became one, and she brought her own costume that did not have a zipper in it, by the way.
Never. Yeah, I mean, it was like the first trip that she took kind of mid-pandemic.
Yeah.
And extras were responsible for making their own costume, so she just, you know, ordered a rustic tablecloth off of Amazon and kind of made it into a shawl. She assured me that she's like not a very good seamstress, but it worked. And I think that feeling of not just watching the show, but being a participant in it, contributing to it, is another reason that people feel so deeply connected to it.
Rachel Monroe, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Rachel Monroe. Her article is called Act of Faith, How the Chosen Spurred a Golden Age of Christian Filmmaking. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.